Approximately 70,000 infants and toddlers with developmental disabilities or delays receive early intervention services every year in New York. But for many families, these critical services aren't delivered until after a lengthy wait and at a costly price tag to the state and county governments. In response to this dynamic, state lawmakers and child advocates are calling on Governor Andrew Cuomo to sign legislation shifting the financial burden of these programs somewhat and potentially creating an opportunity for increased investment in these services. To discuss the pending bill and the early intervention services in New York, we're joined by Bridget Hurley, Senior Director of Advocacy and Program for the Children's Agenda, an advocacy and research organization based out of Rochester. Welcome to the show, Bridget.
Thank you very much.
So when we talk about early intervention services, whether it's for toddlers or infants who have developmental disabilities or cognitive delays, what shape can these services take and how critical are they during this early stage of a child's life?
They are very critical because they are provided at an early stage. What the research shows is that interventions that occur early in a child's life make a difference across their lifespan. And they're much cheaper to provide early in life because that's where you get more bang for your buck. 85% of brain development happens before age three. So the services can really impact the way the brain develops in an infant or a toddler, which helps them gain skills more quickly and secure them sort of, again, for across their lifespan. What early intervention does is, upon the recommendation of a doctor, a child care provider, a parent, a neighbor, a referral could come really from anywhere who notices a child that looks to be not developing in the way that you might normally expect. The first step after the referral is a screening, and that's an assessment to see, to again, sort of measure where the child is at developmentally. If it's indicated that there needs to be further investigation, then there's a full-blown evaluation. And at that point, if a child is deemed eligible, there is a – it's very similar to the IEP that would be used in a special education program for a child K-12. It's an IFSP, an Individual Family Services Plan, because it's developed with the family involvement. And that sets forth what their professionals deem necessary for the child. And then there's a certain series of deadlines within which the services have to be provided under federal law. The important point to remember at this stage is that it is a federal law that mandates services for kids with disabilities, appropriate educational services. And it's exactly the same, again, as if the child was in kindergarten or eighth grade or, you know, as a teenager, they have a right to these services. So the services that are provided by the early intervention program are things like occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech-language pathology. There's also teachers of the blind and deaf. There are social workers who are involved in coordinating the services and serving the child's sort of social-emotional needs. There are psychologists. So it's a whole range of professionals that can be involved in a child's life to help them either catch up developmentally, which many children do at that stage of life when they're an infant or a toddler. They can have speech services for 3 or 6 months and, you know, smooth sailing after that in terms of their developmental progress. If it's a child who has a complicated medical situation, it may be that the child doesn't completely go to the developmental stage where you might be expecting a child that age to be, but they certainly make a lot of progress.
So you mentioned that this is the subject of a federal mandate. But who's actually responsible for picking up the tab at the end of the day in New York?
Right. It's good to ask in New York because this actually does vary across the nation. So for the first thing in terms of who pays for EI is that the parents and family do not. It is designed to be a free service. In New York State, the way the billing works is that a provider provides a service and then bills if a family has private health insurance. The provider will bill the private insurance provider carrier. If it's a child on Medicaid, of course, the claim goes to Medicaid. And then for all the situations where there isn't an insurance coverage, the state and counties combine funds to develop it. There's sort of an escrow fund where those bills, those claims are paid out of.
So then does that mean in examples where someone might have private insurance, the private insurance company ends up picking up most of the tab? Or is this a case where the insurance companies deny a lot of claims and it's the state and county governments that end up paying the bulk of the costs?
Exactly right. So that is the real issue that we're dealing with the legislation that we're talking about, the covered lives legislation. The insurance companies actually reject about 85% of claims that are sent to them by providers. And for contrast, Medicaid covers 75% of the claims that they receive. So the private insurance companies deny far beyond where they should. So the state and counties have to end up picking up the cost of those services.
So how would this legislation, which passed the legislature with overwhelming support earlier this year and is still waiting to be sent to the governor for his signature, affect this dynamic?
What the legislation would do is create a covered lives assessment, which is sort of a health insurance term, covered lives. But what it is, in essence, is an assessment, you might say tax, a fee that would be placed on private insurance companies.
Well, you wouldn't call it a tax if you want the governor to sign it.
I know. I don't call it tax. I don't. I have heard people do that, but I do not. So it is an assessment that would require that insurance companies put a set amount of money each year into this covered life fund. And then the good thing is that the insurance companies would not be processing all these claims and denying them and then getting a resubmission and then denied it again. So they would save time and money on claims processing, and the providers would not have to bill private insurance companies. They would submit a claim, but it would go to this true sum mechanism, would go to the covered lives fund and just get paid.
So if private insurers, through one way or another, end up picking up a larger share of this cost, what would that mean for the money that state and county governments are currently spending on this? Would they keep investing the same amounts, or could they potentially reduce their commitment in accordance with what additional money the private companies are spending?
You know, there are different responses depending on who you ask. I'm in Monroe County. Our county executive is firmly behind the covered lives assessment and firmly behind using the additional revenue coming into the early intervention system to reinvest in the system to increase reimbursement rates, which are lower now than they were in the mid-90s. The providers have not received at all adequate compensation, and many of them are leaving the field. So in order to really save the early intervention system, we need more resources to increase the reimbursement rates. And we, as advocates, would certainly say that the covered lives assessment, the extra money that brings in should be dedicated to investing in the system and increased reimbursement rates. It's theoretically possible that the county and the state could say, hey, you know, on a normal year, the private insurance companies pay about $12 to $14 million in claims. The covered lives assessment under the bill that we're discussing is $40 million. So let's take that extra money and split it, and the counties, you know, get to save half of it, half of that amount, and the state would get to save half that amount. That's, you know, certainly possible. We are strongly saying that would be a mistake, because the system is really struggling and it needs more resources to increase the rates that providers are paid.
If savings were realized and invested back into the program and providers were able to get higher reimbursement rates, what would that mean for the wait lists that some parents find that their kids are on for what I imagine they believe is way too long?
It would reduce those, of course, reduce the wait lists and the time that children have to wait. I just want to say again, this is federally mandated, so it's illegal for there to be a wait list. They should be provided within the timelines designated in the federal law. But they are waiting. If we had higher reimbursement rates, far fewer providers, what we're told by providers is that there are folks who love this work, just cannot pay their bills if they work in the early intervention system. So they go to a hospital or to a school and can make, you know, 50, 60% more in that role as opposed to early intervention. But they really love the little kids. So that's what we're hoping, is that once the reimbursement rates get increased, then there'll be more providers. And because that's really what the delay is. The delay is just that there is no provider. For example, Right now, there's no bilingual evaluation team in Monroe County. So we're counting on bilingual evaluation teams from other counties. And obviously, that's going to mean a wait. I just heard from our county early intervention coordinator that another provider quit today, saying she just can't handle the billing hassles and the waiting, and is going to leave the early intervention system. So that's really the root of the problem that causes the wait list, is that we just don't have enough providers.
During the floor debate on this bill, state lawmakers who ended up voting against this, who spoke during the debate, basically said some version of, well, obviously we want to support the kids as best we can, but I don't like the funding mechanism for this, which is something we've talked about in this interview. Mm-hmm. From your perspective on the provider and front, do you care where this money comes from, or was your focus just on making sure there's enough of it?
We are completely just concerned about there being enough money. We're an independent, nonpartisan advocacy group, as are many, many of our partners around the state that we're working with on this campaign, and the parents and the providers, of course. So, no, it doesn't matter to us where the money comes from. This seems to be a mechanism that would lay the responsibility for paying these claims right where it belongs, which is on the insurance providers who are rejecting far too many claims. So I certainly support the covered lives assessment. I think it's a good mechanism. But no, we don't care too much where it comes from. We just want the kids to get the services that they need when they need them.
Well, we've been speaking with Bridget Hurley. She's the Senior Director of Advocacy and Program for the Children's Agenda. Bridget, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for talking to me.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.